Hey, everyone, it's Nate. This week, there is lots of huge news around the world, and for us record nerds, I'm hoping that this episode will be a ray of sunshine for you, too. This week, we are talking with Rat Scabies, punk rock legend, drummer of the Damned, and professor in the Mad Men. And today, we talk to Rat about a myriad of things, including the early vinyl of the Damned, the rare pressings, working with Malcolm McLaren, Sid Vicious, signing with Stiff, the New Rose single, the collectibles, the Black Album, the creation of Curtain Call, where are all those Damned multi-tracks, and more. It's a really fun and informative conversation with one of the true punk rock icons. Now today we also talked to Rat about his recent project, The Professor and the Madman, a punk rock supergroup whose new album, Seance, is out this week, and you can find it at professorandthemadman.com. There you can order special colored vinyl, CDs, limited edition packaging, and a deluxe version that even comes with a board game. It's pretty cool and unique. You can see more and reserve one for yourself at professorandthemadman.com. And in the spirit of full disclosure, shortly after conducting this interview, there was an announcement of the Damned reformation with some one-time live shows currently scheduled for July 2021 in the UK. Now, this is the first time in over 20 years the original lineup of the Damned is together, and if you're in the UK, you won't want to miss these shows. Now, Rat and I spoke about those as well. However, that's going to be part of a secret episode available only to our Patreon community at patreon.com/vinylguide. Listeners and patrons of the show know that I put a bunch of extra stuff up there on our Patreon site, patreon.com/vinylguide. Go up there now, sign up to help support this podcast, and you'll get that bonus episode along with all sorts of other extended interviews and stuff we put up there. That's at patreon.com/vinylguide, and thank you so much for your support. And before we start the interview, I want to give a big shout out to show sponsor AudiophileUSA.com, the used record shop that ships worldwide and only sells excellent and near mint vinyl records. No scuffs, no skips, no questionable grading. AudiophileUSA.com only sells the best pressings of your holy grails. They have over 42,000 titles in stock, including lots of records by the Damned. Go to AudiophileUSA.com, search their inventory, and buy with confidence. That's AudiophileUSA.com. And also, while you're out there on the interwebs, check out GrooveWasher.com, the best record cleaner on the market. Every vinyl collector needs a record cleaner, so don't settle for some no-name brand. Get the Groove Washer. Ask for it by name at your local record shop or go to groovewasher.com. Use promo code VINYLGUIDE10 and get 10% off whatever you order. Don't settle for less. Get the best at groovewasher.com. Promo code VINYLGUIDE10. Finally, if you enjoy this conversation, check out our other episodes of The Vinyl Guide with interviews of other vinyl record legends, including Henry Rollins, Keith Morris, Bernie Grundman, Jello Biafra, Don Was, Mike Watt, members of AC/DC, Metallica, Black's Flag, and Sabbath, and more. All episodes are available at thevinylguide.com or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get these podcasts. And with the upfronts done, let's get into today's conversation with punk rock legend, drummer of the Damned, and professor in the Mad Men, Mr. Rat Scabies. Testing, testing.
Testing, testing indeed.
Hey, look at you. I'll even turn on my camera. How are you?
Well, what a handsome beast.
It isn't without a lot of work, let me tell you.
It's great talking to you. Great seeing you, Rhett. Look, I am very excited. The new Professor and the Madman album is quite good. I've been listening to it the past few days since I received it from your PR guy. Professor and the Madman, it's a bit of a punk rock supergroup with Alfie Agnew, Sean Elliott, and Paul Gray. Mate, half the band is in England, half are in California. How do you guys get things done?
Long distance, I'm afraid. It's the loneliness of the long distance drummer. They send the files to me and I literally sit there with an engineer and listen to what they've given me and go, okay, this is what I think this needs.
Right.
And do it that way. I have to say, much as I'm a Luddite and I should be opposed to modern technology, I really adore it. Mm-hmm. The convenience. A lot of the things I can put the drums down before I get home on the train. They've got them in California.
Yeah.
And by the time I sit down and put the kettle on, you know, they've already decided if they like it or not. So there's that kind of element to it. All right. But I do really miss the whole band thing, though, sitting in a room with people, mm-hmm. you know, sort of vibing away and talking about, you know.
Just, you're bouncing off one another.
You get a better buzz.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you kind of know whether you're doing it right or not, because you can tell by the mood in the room when you walk in, whereas... You know, the thing with working with just an engineer is that's not really their job. You know, they're there to record it and make sure it sounds good. So mm-hmm. I've been quite lucky because I can kind of read. There's two people I use. So I can kind of read them when I walk in the room. You know, if they're texting somebody on their phone, then I know it wasn't a particularly great take.
Yeah, you notice the eye rolling and everything. Yeah. It's really hard to do that over Zoom.
Yeah.
So was this whole record, Seance, the whole thing was recorded during the pandemic?
Yeah, I think I can't really remember if it had started, but yeah, at the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe slightly before, because the songs weren't written as such. They had the melodies and the chords and guitar parts and things, but they didn't have, you know, a lot of the songs didn't have vocals, so I just had Sean going, la, 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 you know, in the,
right.
In fact, because it's the one thing I always insist on is that there's some kind of vocal and a melody, because that's kind of, it's a song, mm-hmm. you know, that's the whole point of doing it. So that was my only criteria, but it meant actually that I didn't even know it was a concept album until Randy Hager told me it was.
I was going to say, so you participated by playing the drums, writing the drum parts and performing them, obviously, but no lyrical input. That was already part of the story. Come to
you. Yeah, I didn't know what the songs were about. Mm. But having worked with them before, I've got a lot of confidence in those two. They're pretty good and they're very good at being kind of carnival spooky. You know, they're kind of a little bit scared. You know, they understand the clown. And they're the only band I've ever met that have written a song from a stalker's perspective. So I wasn't too bothered about what they were going to do, you know, because I had faith in them. But it was, so when they said, oh, you know, it's a concept album, it's like, oh, really? I don't want to become an old hippie without realizing it.
So Seance being a concept album having to do with the supernatural. Have you ever had any supernatural activities happen in your life? Do you believe in that?
Oh, what a big question. Because I do the grail thing.
The grail, right.
Holy grail. I kind of, yeah. And I found myself in some pretty amazing places from that. And I have seen some very strange things and I've experienced some odd things.
Hang on. Let's not move beyond the grail just yet. What do you mean doing the grail thing?
Well, kind of looking for it, we're not really looking for it so much as taking an interest in the stories and the legend mm-hmm. and the whole thing and what's it actually about, because it's a very powerful story mm-hmm. and it's survived a long, long time and it's, you know, pretty much for something that was kind of a drunk guy reciting a story to a lot of kings and queens and princes and then, you know, because that was the very first kind of the first recorded thing of the Grail legend being spoken. And for something that is that, the weight that it still carries sort of, you know, 500-600 years later, mm-hmm. it shows that there's this sort of need that people have in their spirituality and something to quest after, mm-hmm. to look for, to believe in something else that isn't necessarily a church-bound, you know, or Catholicism or any religion, you know. So mm-hmm. there's, I think that's part of its a part of its appeal. So I, yeah.
Do you believe in, like, and I don't know much about this at all. Do you believe there's a single grail, or do you believe every individual has their own version of the grail?
You see, you always have to go into funny modes when you do this. In answer to your question, yes, I do believe there's a single grail. Mm-hmm. But I've found at least four physical objects that all have, you know, this could be the grail. They're all from the right time frame. They're all the right time period. They're all from the right place in the world. And the answer to the question really is that I don't think there is a physical grail. The whole thing about it is it's always about the journey, the quest, the looking for, the search, self-realization, self-awareness, and the things that you discover about life and you while you're looking. And that, for me, you know, the grail is the quest. That's what it's all about.
You know what? That ties in so well with the theme of this show, which is record collecting.
Right.
And in fact, a lot of us record collectors, we talk about the records that we're searching for. We spend years and years trying to find these records. We call them our holy grails.
Yeah.
And it is about the adventure. Once you get one grail or you get one thing you were looking for, it goes on the shelf, you enjoy it, and then you go out and start searching for the next one.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing is about music and being a collector of anything is actually you're a time traveler. Mm-hmm. And I've often thought that in the studio, it is a kind of element of time travel in so much as you're working on something from the past in the present, which is going to be reviewed in the future.
You know, I always thought music was a great way to time travel, because listening to a song from my youth or years ago, I could be transported straight back to where that was. I could remember an intersection where I was in my car listening to the song. So yeah. Is that the sort of time travel you're thinking, or something different?
Yeah, exactly that. Mm. Exactly that. And you're living on something in the past. I mean, and it doesn't just apply to rock music or anything else. It's, you know, you can buy an album of Gregorian chants, of which hasn't, you know, the actual notation and the way that it's delivered and performed is still exactly the same as it was the day it was written. So there's another kind of thing you can snapshot back and look and listen and say, well, you know, yeah, these guys kind of understood chord sequences and, you know, and notes and melody and harmony. And it's, you know, that gives you an insight. You know, culture is a thing that, the more cultured we are as a society, the more intelligent we are, and the less we do, the less culture that there is, then the more ignorant we are. That's kind of, you know, it's a very sort of French philosophy, I think, that, you know, you have to accept that art is a really important part of life.
Right.
And, you know, and if you don't accept that and you don't have that as part of your life, then actually there's something sadly wrong with your society.
I think there was, during World War II, the city of Kyoto in Japan avoided being bombed by the Allies because the generals in charge thought that it had such culture that, you know, what is a country worth saving if not for its culture?
Yeah, exactly. That's what, why else do you want it apart from the steel minerals? You know, it's not much use to you, you know, and it has a purpose. And it's the same thing during World War II with the Nazis in Paris. You know, they struck a deal of, we're not going to come in because, you know, it's a beautiful city. Hey, we don't want to blow it to pieces. You know, we'll save that for the English.
So do you still listen to records? Do you have a record collection?
I don't have a deck that works at the moment, which is incredibly frustrating. But I do, yes. It's behind this couch. We had some lice in the house, and I had to... I don't even know if I can show it to you, but a lot of my record collection is just over there.
Ah, I see.
And it's all in plastic bags because we had bugs.
You're taking very good care of it, I'm glad to see.
Yeah. So I've had to seal it up for, it's been nearly 2 years now. And apparently that's how long it takes to get the bugs out of the bug. Because I didn't want them to spray them.
Right.
You know, because obviously it's going to crap up all of the covers and everything like that.
Yeah. That's very good. Now, are those the records you've had all these years? Do you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I did the tragic thing, you know, a couple of times I sold records that I really shouldn't have done just because I was too broke and I needed the money to pay for food and stuff like that. And some of them I really regret, but yeah, you know, it's just, you have your record collection.
Yeah.
There's something about just that one statement that everybody understands, that's it's something that's always very special.
Well, in speaking of art, you know, having a record collection is like having your own art collection at home. And it tells so much about you, your tastes, the sort of person you are, and the sort of things you find fascinating. So, yeah, absolutely. I think a record collection is a must for anyone's home.
And socially, you see, pre-COVID, but if you went round to somebody's house to visit, they would have a record on. The great thing about it is it's about 18 minutes aside. But it was actually quite polite. If you didn't like the album that they were playing, it was very polite to rummage through anybody's record collection to see what they had. And, which is a thing that died with CDs. Really, it just, and suddenly somebody puts on a Bruce Springsteen CD. It's 87 minutes long, and there's no way out. Whereas with vinyl, it was brilliant because you could listen, and when it got to the end of side one, you knew you didn't, or the side that they were playing, you could always pull something out that you liked and say, hey, can we put this on next and check, and it was okay to do that. It was a great social interaction that we've lost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things I like about, the resurgence of vinyl, is hopefully that will renew some of that. When I was a kid, you couldn't go out if you didn't have half a dozen albums under your arm while you were waiting for the bus. You were a nobody, and you would strike up conversations with strangers on buses about what's this and what's that. And while you were on the bus, you'd be reading all the info. You'd know who the engineer was, the T-boy, the producer, where it was recorded, because all of that information was easy to see, easy to get to. And people spent a lot of time and trouble making sure that you were entertained by the cover and the information. Mm-hmm. And the same covers and information are there now, but it's in such small print, nobody ever really bothers to read it or look at it.
Oh, absolutely. And you could look at someone who's across the aisle on a bus or in a different seat and say, oh, that's the Monkees.
Yeah.
I have that album. That's, you could start a conversation with a stranger in a very safe and productive manner.
And then immediate common ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's, what have I got in common with you? You're wearing a suit, but you're carrying a Led Zeppelin album.
Yeah.
So it's good. I'm pleased that there is a resurgence.
So what were the records that most inspired you to be a musician?
Oh, really, going back to my very earliest days, were the list usually runs Sandy Nelson, Dave Clark Five, a fair amount of jazz, like Glenn Miller. And big band stuff, because there's, because I didn't really like music as such. I like the drums. And believe me, if I could have made a career without a band, I'd have happily done it. But I realised early on that just me playing the drums wouldn't be enough. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so big band, there's always a drum solo in most jazz tunes. And that was kind of what was going on when I was a kid before the blues explosion in the 60s, and there was only jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I say, most jazz songs have got a drum solo. So I kind of, there was a certain amount of that in there, and it was on the radio and things. But then you moved on to the Monkees or the, that, and then a bit later on, the Who and other groups like that. But I was just really addicted to the sound of the drums. It was anything that had too much thumping in the background was what I wanted. That was.
If there is one drummer or one record that just lit the light bulb over your head about wanting to play the drums or inspired you, which one was it?
Oh, I think it was either. There's two songs that really stand out as being drummery. One was St. Louis Blues March, which was a Glenn Miller kind of big band thing. And that was just so sexy because it was just 20 snare drums playing, it's like, well. And I think the other one probably would have been Sing, Sing, Sing for the same reason, which is what's his name? Louis Prima.
Okay.
Which again is just, it's drum led.
Yeah.
But what's going on with the band around it as well. It's a brilliant piece of music, well arranged, well written, as is dynamic, but just won't quit. And, most of my thing was that I couldn't really play, so I'd hear records and think, wow, I wonder how they do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then just kind of nagging at parents until I got a drum kit, and now I've just started trying to figure out how they did do it.
How are your folks with the drum kit in the house?
Well, my father, bless him, we had a three-bedroom terraced house where I sort of had my first drum kit. And then I don't know where he got the money from, but he suddenly managed to buy this huge place out in the country, which was big enough where I could play and they didn't have to listen to me. So I think it was mostly deliberate, you know, this move to this wonderful place. But they were okay. You know, they worked quite a lot. So usually it was the neighbors that would suffer.
So you don't know where your dad got the money. Do you think it was legitimate how he got it?
Oh, yeah. I don't think it was that. I think he was a great negotiator. And I think the people that were selling the house sounds quite terrible now, was a raving alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And I think he got her when she was drunk to agree a really low price.
And then that became your first practice studio.
Well, kind of, yeah. It was quite amazing. It was a really big place, and they had this big conservatory, and I used to set the drums up out in the garden. Mm-hmm. But behind us was an aerodrome where they used to have all these vintage World War One and World War Two planes.
Oh, okay. Anyone used to living around an airport is going to be fine with a drum set.
Well, it was only a small aerodrome. So they would practice. They would do these like dogfight battles and things, and they practiced doing that. So I'd be there playing, looking up, and there'd be these two tiger moths souping and soaring around, and then a Spitfire would go past. And it was just kind of, it was something I got quite used to.
Would you try to create a soundtrack for it while you watched it?
Well, that was the interesting thing, because it's only the second I've made that kind of connection. But the very first time I played with Brian James, mm-hmm. they were very bored with auditioning drummers. Interviewing. mm-hmm. Auditioning drummers. And they'd got a TV in the, you know, rehearsal room, mm-hmm. which they were watching while we were playing. And they had this sort of, it was some kind of a move, you know. But I remember sitting there watching the TV and playing along with them and thinking, this sucks. And then there was a war movie on TV, and it was a dogfight with these aeroplanes going in. And Brian started following what was going on the screen with his guitar. So it was like, and he was, and that's a laugh. And for me, I doubt if that was the actual moment it all kicked into gear, but for me, I remember that as being the point where I went, okay, now it's time to open up and show them what I can do. So that was when, you know, he and I both started mm-hmm. playing.
Now, was Brian part of Masters of the Backside? That was the band you had the project with Chrissy Hynde, right?
Yeah. That was sort of put together by Malcolm, really. Mm-hmm. And he'd found Dave Vanian. And there was another Dave Zero, I think he was called, who was the exact opposite of Vanian. So you had Vanian, who was very kind of dark and, you know, I don't know, muscly and gothy kind of guy. And then we had Dave Zero, who was like this absolutely sort of camp hairdresser from South London, who had this brilliant sense of humour. He was really, you know, he had a tongue like a razor. And it was like he would just, he cut to the chase. And so Malcolm's idea was to have these two opposites singing. And Chrissy was going to be disguised as a boy. She wasn't going to sing. Mm. She was only going to play guitar. And she'd only just started learning. And the only bass player that anyone knew was the captain. Mm. So we had a couple of rehearsals, but I have to be honest and say, you know, after playing with Brian James, you know, Chrissy just learning to play wasn't as good. You know, and also the fact that she wasn't singing, because I hung out with her a bit, you know, while we were doing things, and mm-hmm. I heard her voice, and it was like, this is insanity. This woman has got this amazing voice, and you're disguising her as a boy.
Yeah.
And you're not letting her sing. Yeah. It's, you know.
Every wonderful asset she brought to the table was not being utilized.
Yeah, and I suspect, actually, it was as much she didn't want to do. I think she just really wanted to play guitar in a band. Mm-hmm. And she just wanted to figure out, as she used to say, get my chops together. So,
how much of Masters of the Backside was organic and how much was manufactured by Malcolm?
Malcolm's thing was just the people and putting them in a room. You know, he didn't really care what you played mm-hmm. or what songs it was. Yeah, I remember the only song I remember us ever playing was Give Me Some Loving, which was kind of on a loop. because it was the only one that everybody knew. But Malcolm wasn't, he didn't really get involved artistically in everything. He'd already chosen people because of the way they looked and the attitudes they had.
Right.
Because it was, it was very easy to spot people that were different with short hair and drainpipe trousers back then. So, but he didn't really have that much to do with what we did, I don't think. But like I say, it didn't really last very long. It was only a few weeks and some half a dozen rehearsals.
Was he the one who introduced Sid into the band? He was going to audition originally?
No, Sid just turned up at a Sex Pistols gig at a place called the Nashville Rooms.
Mm.
Had his lame teddy boy jacket on and his hair and everything. And he looked great. No, he was. That was how that came. And it was, the same night we saw Dave. But I know there was some mess up with phone calls and a number, and he never made it to the audition. So.
We always hear stories of Sid being, a mess. And I've always wondered how much of that was an act and to what level was he truly that unpredictable?
I think he was that unpredictable. And I think that punk rock let him actually let go of all of that. I think he'd sort of, he was already there with his attitudes and philosophies. And I think then suddenly everyone went, yeah, we want to know more about this.
Okay.
We want to know. Yeah, you go and okay, Sid, you're off the leash. You can do whatever you want. And I think that was
okay.
But he was a very smart guy. He had some amazing sort of philosophies and observations on things, and he did have a great sense of humour. He was actually quite funny, which could be quite cruel and twisted, But actually, he wasn't too bad to hang out with.
But he was aware he was a bit of a caricature at that point?
Yeah, I think so. But then again, so was everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Rotten, that wasn't normal. that wasn't what everyone else was doing,
So I understand the Damned had several record labels courting the band early on, and you chose Stiff. Do you recall what those other labels were and maybe why you didn't go in that direction?
It was everyone, really. Every label wanted to sign a punk band, and we got offers from all of them at one time or another.
Were you considered safer than Sex Pistols at that point?
No.
Okay.
I don't know if we were. I don't know how we were seen. I think we were just seen as that other band that's quite together, I suppose. Well, I'm together in a way, but we had songs and we'd sort of been rehearsing and gigging. And the thing was that Stiff Records were funny, They really didn't care about the mainstream and CBS Records or all the other EMIs or the big labels that were there. And they really were determined to be noticed. And the fact that you could talk to Jake Riviera and he would, and if you were talking about the MC5 or the Stooges, he'd know the albums. He'd have the albums.
Mm-hmm.
He'd cite things to, it was somebody you could talk to. Whereas everybody we'd met from the majors really just wanted to sign us because they saw that punk was going to be the next fashionable thing and they could shift a few units,
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd make that same decision now. I'm not sure if I would.
Mm.
But they were a lot more fun, And you'd get things done if you'd go into the office and Jake said, oh, we need some badges. What colour should we have? And you just, I don't know, purple and green. And they'd be there a couple of hours later. They used to make things happen. And if they said, right, we're going to do this. And, like when we went into Record New Rose, we did the Montemar Sound Festival and Jake just came up and said, right, as soon as we get back to England, we'll book the studio. Nick's going to produce it and we're going to go in and record it. What do you think? And it was okay.
Mm.
It was just what we wanted because we'd heard of Jake and we'd heard of the label and we liked, what they were doing.
Now, did you record New Rose and Help along with the rest of the album or were those separate and earlier and the album came later?
I think we did them first. I think we went in just to do the single.
Mm-hmm.
As memory serves, but everything was done so quickly.
Sure.
Back then, it was. I think that was how it went.
Of course, New Rose is the very first UK punk record. Was that important to be the first band with a punk record out there?
It didn't bother me at all. You know, I didn't really think of it like that. Mm-hmm. But I guess Jake and other people saw an importance to it, you know, to be the first ones. And I guess, you know, probably kind of quite a good business decision.
Yeah.
But, I never ever thought I'd even get into a studio and have a record come out. You know, that was kind of beyond your dreams, wildest dreams.
Did you take a copy of that record and give it to your dad at that time?
There was a whole story about my dad and that record. Because I went up to borrow money from him just after we'd recorded it. And I went around, you know how you do with your parents. Mm-hmm. And Dad, can you do me a favor? You know, he said, well, you got a job? And I said, well, I've just made a record, you know. And he went, yeah, lots of people make records that never get released, you know. And he said, don't, you know. And he just kind of threw me out of the house, really. And then, of course, as soon as it came out, I got a copy and I went straight up there on the train and went, there it is. And he put it on his stereo and played New Rose. Then he turned it over and played Helping. Him and my mother were big Beatles fans. Yeah. And so I just always remember my mother's face of Help going on, and she just looked absolutely appalled at what was going on and what was coming out of the speakers. And then he got up and he turned it over and he played New Rose again. And then he got up and played Help again. And he played New Rose again. And he played Help again. And then he just reached into his pocket and gave me £5.
And that was your first royalty check.
That was my first royalty check.
Now, when the album came out, obviously the cover of the album is this iconic picture at this time. What do you recall about taking that photo with the pie and the cake and you licking the captain's head?
I remember thinking, oh no, you're not going to be a rock star with that shit all over your face, you know? And I wasn't very keen on the idea, but everybody else who was there, like Judy Nylon and Peter Godick, were like, no, man, this is going to be fucking great. This is going to be really good. Mm-hmm. And they took some straight pictures as well. So we all sort of thought, oh, okay, you know.
So they took the straight pictures and then in came the cake.
And then in came the cake, which was actually shaving cream and tomato ketchup. So it wasn't even really edible. It wasn't like we could eat from it. It was just like, you've ruined a perfectly good flan there. Can you get real cream? It was. But, yeah, I didn't like the idea. And then once I'd seen it, it was like, oh, yeah, now this totally makes sense. It's completely anti, you know, satin jackets and fluffy hair.
Whose idea was it for that photo shoot?
I don't know if it was Judy Nylon or Peter Kodik. It was one of those two. Mm. Or I don't know. Mm. But it definitely wasn't mine.
But you got a free meal out of it. That's nice. the back cover of the album, some of the early pressings had a mistaken picture of Eddie and the Hot Rods on it. Any idea how that happened?
The first 2000. Mm-hmm. And rumor has it that Jake Riviera did it on purpose because he knew that all of the collectors would buy that album because of the mistake. Mm-hmm. And if he sold 2,000 copies, then that would pay for the album's recording.
Wow.
And he would recoup. So that was what I heard. Because then, you know, I don't know if you remember how vinyl used to be manufactured. I'm not sure how it is today, but you couldn't make exactly 2,000. Mm-hmm. You get like 1907 or 2008 or, you know, you.
Right.
So nobody knows. So, I mean, yeah, there's a few still around.
And those copies go for insane amounts of money, several hundred dollars, if not into the thousands. What's your reaction when you see a damned record going for $1,000 or $2,000?
I'm very glad I sold it.
Yeah. You still have some that you're peeling out? Is that the?
Not some, but Jake Riviera had some that he'd kept from the day, and on my birthday he gave me a copy.
Oh,
it's still sealed, and you know. Yeah, I sold it. But I've got one other copy that Jake actually signed for me.
Okay.
I'm, just trying to figure out how to get everyone to sign it. It's really because it just says, sorry, Jake.
So yours was the, so let me ask you this. Yours was the copy that was sealed with the red stickers, damn, damn, damned, and the Eddie and the Hot Rods. That was you.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. I'm very glad to hear it went to a member of the band.
Well, you know, the other thing is it was only going to sit under my bed in a box.
Yeah.
I was never going to open it and play it or do anything like that with it. And I kept quite a lot of bits and pieces, and I've sold a lot of it because really it belongs out there with people that want it mm-hmm. more than I do, rather than just leaving it in a box. I'd rather sell the poster to somebody who's going to put it on their wall, who's going to, you know, appreciate it and has a better purpose for it than I do, whereas I could do with the money.
Fair enough. Now, Henry Rollins was on our show, and you probably know he's a rabid damned collector, mm-hmm. and he tries to get at least one of everything. He's even shared that he's reached out to various band members, damned and other punk bands, looking for test pressings, acetates, all that sort of thing. Has Henry reached out to you to see what you have stashed away?
Yeah, I know Henry. There's two guys that spend big money on memorabilia. One of them's in Vienna and the other one's Henry.
Yeah.
And if there's something on eBay that they both want, it goes through the roof. I mean, you know, there was a damned Motorhead adverts poster that belonged to Gay Advert. Mm-hmm. And they sold, you know, it went for £9,000.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, if you can get real lucky and get those two bidding against each other, you can retire to the south of France for the rest of your life, I think. But Henry, I like Henry, but he is a very serious collector. He's kind of compelled. It has to be perfect, and it has to be mm-hmm. everything has to be exactly right on it, or it's, you know, it doesn't count.
Ah, okay. So you've revealed your collection to Henry and.
Well, bits and pieces. I sold him the original model for the Black Album, you know, the cover. Oh. That was the thing, because I had it.
Oh, okay. The molded item. Oh, that's awesome. What was that made of? And how did it wind up in the Rat Scabies collection?
We had a really great artist called Humphrey Leadbitter who mm-hmm. made that. And at the same time, he did the gravestone for History of the World. And when we went down to do it, that was kind of like a fiberglass mold of the brick wall. And Dave had designed the logo and the lettering, and Henry had turned it into the kind of plaque thing. But then he covered it with ivy and put the snail on the wall. And there you go.
Yeah.
And all of that stuff. And it actually, you can see just on the top left-hand corner above the A where there's a hole in the plaque.
Yep.
It accidentally got broken while we've...
How did it actually get broken? Someone's thumb went through it or something?
I don't know. It just turned up like that. I think I just remember it being that. And at the end of the shoot, I said, well, what's happening with this stuff? And Dave and I were the only two that had turned up. And we got to choose which one we wanted, and Dave chose the headstone, and I got the Black Album cover. Oh. But again, it was another one of those things that was just sitting in the wardrobe, not really doing anything other than gathering dust.
Wow.
And, you know, until they open the Rat Scabies Museum of Memorabilia, you know, it's, again, you know, I'd rather that Henry had it.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. But you're very clever back in the day to be able to realize that this is something of interest, something to hang on to.
Well, only because it was quite cool. You know, it was, I guess, I just sort of remember thinking, oh, that looks pretty good. But, you know, I didn't really take care of a lot of the stuff because I didn't really have anywhere to live permanently for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of always moving around or in somewhere else or on the road or whatever. So, like I say, most of it just ended up in boxes, just sort of not really doing anything. And now I do have a house. I don't really have the space for a lot of it anyway.
Now, with the Black Album, it was such a career turn. The band really seemed like it took direction from no one. They went with their instincts at this time. Was it difficult to convince the record company, Chizik, right?
Yeah.
Was it difficult to convince them to release the Black Album as designed?
No. In fact, Roger Armstrong was there all the way through. I think he had a lot of faith in the band as being capable of doing something different or special, you know. They did used to nag us. They used, you know, we'd get Roger on the phone and like, listen, we really need a top 10 single. And Captain and I'd sort of burst out laughing. It's like, yeah, sure, we'll just knock one out, shall we? Because we didn't have a clue. Mm-hmm. We had no idea how to write a top 10 single or what you'd have to do to make one. So we just knew that we only did what we liked. Mm-hmm. So you're quite right, you know, the direction of that album. Because it started out as just going to be a single album. And then during dinner one evening, Dave happened to have his lyric book in his bag, and I sort of said, what's that? You know, he took it out and opened it to a page, and it was the lyrics for Curtain Call. And I just read the first line, you know, we're coming up from the deep, the lizard sheds its skin, night obliterates the day, and all the fun begins. And I'm like, how long have you had these? But, you know, this is, what is it? And then that, you know, him and Captain were a great pair working together, because Dave was quite limited on his abilities with music, but he did know a certain amount and he could pick out certain notes. And Captain, of course, on the other hand, was a great interpreter of those ideas. Mm-hmm. And Dave had the whole kind of thing mapped out in a way. And at the time, we were quite fortunate that Hans Zimmer was pretty much unemployed in those days. Mm. And Roger had managed to get him, well, managed, said, we'll give you 50 quid if you come and produce the Damned record, you know. And so he did. So it, in this sort of strange way, everything sort of came together at once. We had Roger, who was giving us the freedom to do what we wanted. We had Hans Zimmer, who was, you know, pretty good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this sudden conceptual kind of thing that was really knocked the Damned's perception of itself out of the park. Mm-hmm. And so that was why it ended up being a double album, was because we recorded Curtain Call and then we had three sides.
Yeah.
So then we did a live show just so we could fill up side four. It wasn't that we wanted to make a double album, because record companies hated double albums because they cost a lot more to do. They didn't make that much more money on them. And because being punks as well, we wanted the same price as a single album, you know, that whole stand-up thing. You're in the same price. Our punters can't afford it. And so the record company go, oh, well, we've just lost everything on that. But they went with it, bless them. And you know, they stuck with it as the double album. I'm very pleased they did.
There must have been at least some challenging conversations about that. I mean, because even I would imagine as you're recording the songs, you're starting to see how Curtain Call has probably evolved from, you know, something 5 to 8 minutes that keeps going and going and going to take up a whole side. Mm-hmm. At what point did you realize that, okay, this is something that is way different than anything else that is out there?
Well, that's as soon as I read those lyrics, really, mm-hmm. and realized that this was something that Dave had mapped out and had decided he wanted to do, and wasn't sure if we could do it. I mean, that was...
At the time when you saw those lyrics, did you know it was going to be a 20-minute song at that point? It was going to be opus like that?
No. No, they were just great lyrics. And I thought, okay, well, you know. And then Dave and the captain would lock themselves away late at night with beer and then work and put things together and interpret and record some of it. And then the next day I'd sort of put drums. And then, you know, that whole, you have to remember as well, the synthesizer had just arrived. Mm-hmm. And so the thing of using, you know, sequences and stuff like that. And Hans was really good with all of that kind of stuff. So, mm-hmm. you know, it sort of lent itself. And other things that Hans was really good at was old-fashioned studio technology, like with tape. Because I remember the violin part that comes in. Mm-hmm. We just had that on a loop of quarter-inch tape that literally went around mic stands, the backs of chairs, coat hooks, around the whole room. You know, it was about 30 or 40 feet long just to get that kind of timing on it. So it worked. So, you know, and doing backward things, which meant turning tapes over and, mm-hmm. you know, right, we want backward cymbals on this bit, you know, and it was suddenly, so the headphones are just going, wow, and so they want to hear, do they? You know, and just kind of bashing and hoping. But yeah, and I think that's one of the things that sets it aside is that there is a lot of good technical stuff on it as well that worked.
Well, that is wonderful, because I'm so glad this album exists, and that a lot of times artists aren't given the permission to do something like this. It's considered rather indulgent, which it may be, but that's the job of the artist. And the fact that you were able to do all this and not encounter the resistance.
I think we got real lucky with our audience. Mm-hmm. I think that we were smoking too much pot, and we'd sort of discovered that whole kind of, actually, it doesn't have to be all the time.
Right.
And we could introduce subtlety, and we could introduce different things. But the luckiest break was that our audience were also ready to do the same thing. You know, they wanted to hear something different that wasn't what they'd been living with for the previous few years, you know, or listening to for the previous few years. So, mm-hmm. you know, we didn't really know how our audience would take to it. But luckily, like I say, they were ready for us to make that change and came with us.
Well, you've had so many different unique experiences in your career and different phases, not only Damn, 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 the Black Album, Phasmagoria, but also now Professor and Madman. Mm. How did you connect up with Alfie and Sean, being on the other side of the world?
I happened to be with a mate of mine in California, Darren McNamee. He had his band, Cockfight, I think that's called. Yeah. And they were playing in, you know, you Americans have this thing where you wear dreadful Christmas sweaters.
Yes, I'm aware there's a trend like that.
Right, well, there was a dreadful sweater party, which is where they were playing, and Alfie and Sean were playing as well. And, I mean, there was about 20 people there, I think, with the dreadful Rudolph with flashing noses and gnomes and things. And they just, you know, being Damn fans, they just sort of started talking to them, and they invited me up to jam, and then they invited me over to Alfie's house the following day, and he's got a studio, so I put drums on a track for them. And then, you know, I got back to England, and they said, well, let's do it again, you know, and now we can. We'll just send you over the files, and we'll see how that works out. And it did. So, you know.
Yeah. Now, understanding there's you've had quite a colorful life in terms of the drumming capabilities. As I get older, I'm finding it harder and harder to do physical activity. I would imagine you're very much the same. How often are you drumming, and how do you stay fit as a drummer?
I don't really bother that much. I just, I don't know. As you can see, I've got the dreadful electric kit behind me that I put time in with. But you know what? Most of the thing I still do is, you know, tapping on my legs like I always did when I was a kid.
Do you drum every day? Do you get on the kit every day? Or can you go a week or two and then just pick it up, no problem?
I generally pick it up, yeah. When I record, I'm very intense. You know, I usually have at least two projects that I need to put drums on over a period of 2 or 3 days.
Okay.
So I kind of go in and I, you know, I'm okay, you know, I've got to do 5 tracks today, otherwise I'm going to be behind on the schedule, so... You kind of, I don't know. I mean, it sort of dawned on me that actually I'm probably just playing the same thing at different speeds over and over on everybody's record.
But the fact that you could be drumming for an entire day and a couple of sessions in a row, that's quite good. You know, that's a lot of physical activity to be able to just turn on without a whole lot of buildup or preparation.
Yeah, I think so. I'm starting to feel it a lot now since the lockdown, because, you know, I like to stay pretty active, and I walk a lot of places, and I, you know, and do all of that kind of, and all of that's been taken away. So, you know, I can still go out, but there's no real sort of purpose for going anywhere. You know, it's just sort of, I'll go out for a walk and say, oh, really? And, you know, why? So I'm just sort of thinking, because they're just putting us, well, they just put us on another 6 months they're looking at. So I think, you know, I've got to figure out some kind of a regime, because just sitting there playing Scrabble on my phone, you know, my thumb's beginning to hurt and seizing up.
Now, was Disintegrate Me recorded face-to-face with the rest of the band, or was that also remote?
No, it's all been remote.
Oh, wow.
Really, apart from the first track I ever did with them, I think. I can't remember what that was called. much to my shame. Apart from when they came over to London and we played one show at the 100 Club, which was, you know, which was pretty intense. Because I said, well, let's do a tour. You know, you're here. Mm-hmm. You've got to fly. And Alfie just said, no, we're doing one. That's it. We do one show and we get it right. And I thought, well, that's pretty good.
Is it true you guys have only played one show together?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Were there any plans for a second show?
Well, that's what I said. You know, I said, you're here. We might as well do 10, you know, as one. Alfie was just very adamant. He was like, nope, we're doing one show and that's it.
Yeah, I guess he's got to get back home and grade some papers.
Make more money. Sell another house.
And that the name of the band, Professor and the Madman, obviously he's a professor.
The mathematics.
Yeah. But there's also that book that came out, The Professor and the Madman. And I read that about 20 years ago. And I was astonished to understand that the band also took name from that same book.
Did they? I didn't know that story. I thought it was actually because Sean really was out of control.
Right. I think there's a good argument to be made why it should be called Professor and the Mad Men. but yeah, there is a book, Professor and the Madman, about a gentleman who helped write the Oxford English Dictionary.
Oh.
And it's a fascinating book. I read it about 20 years ago. And I believe what I read is correct, that the band was partially named in homage to that book.
Well, yeah, but also with a very strong underlying sense of reality.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's very descriptive, very apt. Mm. So Disintegrate Me came out in 2018. That's a fantastic album. And when I heard Seance is coming out, I was quick to jump on that one as well. Are there any other plans for Professor and the Mad Men right now?
Not this week.
No?
Not at the moment. I guess they'll want to get this one released and out of the way before we start on the next one. Mm-hmm. But generally they go quiet for a few months and then I'll get an email from Sean or Alfie saying, hey, you know, got some tracks. Mm-hmm. You know, so I always say, yeah, okay, here we go. Don't put any drums on it. No drum machines. No drum machines, and it must have vocals.
Do you have any rules about that sort of thing? Absolutely, yeah. No drum machines.
Absolutely no.
Okay.
No, because what happens is everything gets built around the drum machine. Mm-hmm. If it's there, you can't help it, you know. And I don't really want to have to work with someone else's drum ideas. They're not a drummer. They're a guitarist who's put some drums so they can play along to it. Whereas a drummer's mind works different.
They don't even give you scratch tracks or anything.
No, I won't let them. Like, just a metronome really is all I want.
Okay.
I play with a guitar and a voice. You know, if they're singing, don't do any fills. If it's guitar, do as many fills as you can that go with the guitar. But the guitar is the kind of, mm-hmm. you know, that's what I lock in with. And I think that's, you know, why Paul Gray works so well on the records as well, is because his train of thought is as a bass player. So the spaces that he finds aren't the spaces that I find, you know, so we have a very sort of complementary way of doing it. So that, I think that it works on that level. But yeah, no, I just give me a click. And my only other criteria really is it must have vocals of some kind. It must have a melody. You know, I need to know where the verse and choruses start and stop. I need to know what happens in the middle bit,
right.
You know, when it goes quiet or when it gets loud. You know, those are the... So, but just as long as it's got that on it, yeah, I'm kind of quite happy.
Now, does Paul live nearby? Do you guys listen to the tapes and practice together?
No, he lives in Cardiff. It's like about 150 miles away. So, you know, and I hadn't seen him for years apart from when we did that one gig. It was quite an important gig in a lot of ways because we managed to kind of sort of say hello and kind of, I don't know, there's a lot of water under the bridge. Mm-hmm. That. So it was nice to reacquaint and realise, you know, actually, you know, he's a great bass player. And you kind of, I'd forgotten that.
So the new album also comes with a punk rock board game, from what I understand. Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't seen it. They, I just got sent a CD by Randy. So I want to see the board game. I want to play this thing.
Do you know anything about it? Is it like any concept of it? Are you a board game fan at all?
As I said, I've been playing Scrabble quite a lot lately, but that's, you know, that's about it.
From what I understand, this album also has some special vinyl pressings. I believe there's a special yellow and a special purple vinyl. Those are some of the collector's items that are available. People can go to professorandthemadman.com. I'll put the links in this episode page, and you can order the CD, the digital version, the vinyl version, colored and not colored, and then you could also have the board game along with it, which sounds really interesting. I'm going for the board game and the colored vinyl. I'm going for the full package. I want the full Professor and the Madman experience. So yes, you must be pretty excited about it. Let me ask you, out of all the work you've done in your career, all the master tapes, those sort of things, do you know if they're accounted for or if there's anything in particular that's lost, something, some important piece out there that's missing?
A lot of stuff got lost. I've got the multi-track to New Rose. Mm. We don't know where the other multi-tracks have gone. I personally think that was because the tape was very expensive in those days. Mm-hmm. So I think the, you know, our first album probably got used for Elvis Costello's My Name Is True or something. Okay. And the second album, we did try to find that because we wanted to remix it and try and make it more psychedelic, but just nowhere to be found. And again, I think the same thing was that tape was expensive and it was, you know, used for something else. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, which is kind of okay because when you make an album and you finished it and there's the master and it's a snapshot in time. Mm-hmm. It's a thing. So I'm not sure how much I like that sort of remixing and reissuing of things. I think kind of, you know, you don't go and touch up a Rembrandt because, you know, you don't go, oh, yeah, we got a new shade of yellow and it's acrylic paint. That looked really good on that Van Gogh over there with the sun flat. You know, you don't do that. You don't tart it up and freshen it up. You know, and I think in a lot of ways, the album that you make or the recordings you make are solely representative of that point in time. And maybe that's how they should stay.
Well, certainly losing the tapes gives you permission to move beyond it.
Well, there's a pretty good get out of jail card as well for that. We've lost the masters.
So all the Chizik stuff, Machine Gun Etiquette,
album. They've probably still got it. I should think Roger and Ted, you know, they were pretty good about things like that. So I'd be surprised if they didn't.
And all the music from that period, does the band own and control it?
No.
Or some corporation has it somewhere? And
yeah. Well, in the real world, you know, owning it ourselves was okay, but you ended up licensing it to a major anyway. Mm-hmm. And actually, we ended up with a much better deal when we sold them to a major. You know, we got a higher royalty rate, we got an advance, we got the thing, and they pay you. So instead of having to go through a lot of kind of misery of trying to make it work and hustling people to promote it and make sure that it's available and all of those things that you have to do, you know, actually it's a much easier life just letting the big boys do what they do every day. Mm-hmm.
Do you get the phone calls every so often? Hey, we want to use neat, neat, neat in a Volvo commercial. Do you get those sort of things?
No, not very often. Sometimes I get that asked, but like I say, it's not really mine to do that with anymore. So I guess it's the strangest thing. You know, I go to the supermarket and the Stranglers are playing. And it's like, boy, in 1976, you wouldn't even let the Stranglers come in here. You know, you'd have called the cops. I find it really odd that, you know, now this sort of commerciality and acceptance of punk rock is now mainstream. You know, I don't think it's bad that Iggy Pop did a car insurance commercial, because why shouldn't you? If somebody wants to pay your rent and give you some money, then actually that's there, that's what you do. And, you know, the same with butter adverts and Johnny Rotten. You know, that it's fair game, I think. And if you can get it, you can get it. But I think that in some degrees there's sort of moral grounds, you know, there are some things maybe you shouldn't be a part of. But but like I say, we don't really have anything to do with it anymore. It's the, you know, men in suits, aging punks that used to be down the front gobbing at us are now running major labels.
And petrochemical companies.
So, Rat, with Professor and the Madman safely in the can and being pressed onto vinyl, what other projects are you involved in? What other music are you doing these days?
My pet love at the moment is the Sinclairs. We've just had an album come out just as lockdown started.
Oh.
Called Sparkle, which is me and Billy Shinbone, who plays guitar with Neville Staple and used to have a band called Flipron.
Okay.
And he and I decided to make a surf punk instrumental sort of slightly unnerving record.
Right.
Which, as I say, came out on red vinyl. So I'm very pleased. I would say it's a nice little album, but it's got elements that are, you know, the slogan we used was easy listening made more difficult.
Oh, okay. So I've actually found it here. The Sinclairs Sparkle Limited Edition Red Vinyl. And, it's on Cleopatra.
Yeah.
It looks like. So I'll put that link in the episode page. So that's an instrumental surf type music. Okay.
We made a couple of videos that are worth checking out as well.
Well, Rat, I really want to thank you for coming here on the show and sharing all those stories of your musical history and, of course, talking about the new project, Professor and the Madman. People can check it out at professorandthemadman.com. There's vinyl records up there. There's board games up there. There's colored vinyl. And, of course, Rat's other project, the Sinclairs, which is on cleorex.com. I'll put links to all this stuff in the episode page. And, again, Rat, thank you so much for not only coming on the show and talking about records, but also being part of my youth and being part of the records that I loved as a kid and I still love to this very day. You've played a huge role in the soundtrack of my life, and I can't thank you enough for doing what you
did. I was only doing what I loved. That's the great thing about it. You know, if you do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say things like that to me, and it's very difficult to understand that you were a part of someone else's life, because really I was just doing what I wanted to do, what I enjoyed doing, and what I would have done anyway. Even if I hadn't have been in the Damned, I'd have still played the drums somewhere, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But no, thank you.
No worries.
Okay, take it easy.
Thanks again, Rat.
All right, cheers, man. Bye.
Go, punk rock legend himself, Mr. Rat Scabies, and we were talking about his new project, The Professor and the Madman. Check it out at professorandthemadman.com. Again, vinyl records, board games, all sorts of stuff up there. We're also having a bonus episode, a secret episode, going up in the next day or so, a conversation with Rat about the Damned reunion. And that's going to be available only to our Patreon community, patreon.com/vinylguide. Go up there now, sign up. It may already be up there. I'm not sure about the timing of all these things and when you're listening to this. But if you go to patreon.com/vinylguide, I do know that you will help support this podcast, help keep us going, and also get access to all sorts of secret episodes, extended interviews, and more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And thank you so much in advance for your support. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for listening. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on your Facebook, your Instagram, tweet them out on Twitter. That is always a huge help. And it's also fantastic if you can catch up with your record buddy friends, tell them about this podcast. And if they don't know how to get podcasts on their smartphone, show them how to do it and help them get into The Vinyl Guide. And of course, record nerds love that sort of thing. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.